Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White, this time phoning in from Austria, I believe. How are you, Dad?
Yep, phoning in from Austria and with a heavy cold. So, it's not ideal circumstances, but I'm here and it's good to be speaking, Tim.
Yep, I'm also slightly recovering from illness, so you might notice a slight nasal tone in my voice as well. So bear with us as we struggle through.
So Tim is suffering from one of the great delights of parenthood.
Catching your children's illnesses.
Exactly.
Yeah. And somehow the grown-ups seem to get it worse than the little ones, but not sure how that works. But anyway, enough about our own travails. Today we are kind of picking up a series that we began last month, or maybe even longer, I can't quite recall, which was looking at the kind of grand narrative of Scripture, the kind of Christian story through four, a kind of lens that says it divides it into four episodes, creation, fall, redemption, and new creation. And last time we covered the first of those, creation, didn't we?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you haven't listened to that episode, we would recommend it. But in brief, we were trying to argue that the understanding of the wonder and the goodness and the joy, which is fundamentally part of the creation, is such an important message, which unfortunately is often lost, particularly in Christian circles. And I find that one of the great paradoxes. But so the idea of the goodness of what God has made is a fundamental Christian truth, which we need to, we never move beyond it. And we said, didn't we, that even in the picture of the throne room in heaven, that the creation is being celebrated there in the very presence of God on into eternity.
That's right. And to quickly explain, for people who might be kind of puzzled why we're here, stepping away from our more usual fare, I think the thinking is that this kind of theological framework that we're expounding, it lies behind how we approach a lot of the more kind of grounded, down-to-earth examples, you know, whether that might be artificial intelligence or embryo research or transgender ideology. You know, we can't think clearly as Christians about some of these incredibly new and exciting or concerning developments in science technology if we don't have a kind of decent theological framework of creation, of humanity, of who God is, about where we're going as a species, as a cosmos. So this is a kind of effort to explain and make the case for the kind of theological foundation that we then, the lens with which we try and approach some of these more novel ideas.
Yeah, and so today we're looking at the nature of evil, because this is the second of the great foundations of the biblical narrative, and of course this is such a profound issue in today's world. We just listening to the news, you know, at the time we're recording this, the Middle East is alight with violence and because of warfare between Israel and Hamas. In Palestine, there are demonstrations around the world. There is the Ukraine conflict still going on, and terrible bloodshed and suffering there. And in the tech world, you know, there is huge concern about the risks of new technology, the way that unexpected evil seems to emerge out of, and the potential for evil in the technology. So evil is a really important concept in our world, and sometimes it can feel overwhelming.
That's right. I mean, it just reminded me just there that this very week, as we record, the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is kind of convening an international summit here in the UK about artificial intelligence and trying to get countries to come together to kind of agree some guardrails and some frameworks, because there's, as you say, real concern that the trajectory we've started down in developing some of these software tools could, in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, unleash quite significant problems for us as a society, as a species. So this is something that the wider world is grappling with, but how do we think evil is understood in secular society? What is their kind of intellectual approach to that?
Well, I find it very interesting that, you know, reading a lot about the tech world and the writings of technologists, it's very interesting to me that it seems that within an entirely materialistic and physicalist worldview, which is really the dominant worldview in the tech world, evil doesn't really compute. It's a deep mystery because, you know, technologists, they can understand programming mistakes and programming errors. They can understand that, you know, a computer might malfunction. They can understand random disasters, you know, like earthquakes and disasters like that. But the idea of personal malevolence, the idea that people might do evil things without any rationale, is something it just doesn't compute. I mean, why would people do that? And yet, what we observe repeatedly is that evil seems to emerge even when intentions are good. So, you know, I think it's pretty clear that many of the people leading technology in the Silicon Valley genuinely want to do good for humankind. When Mark Zuckerberg originally had an idea that, you know, he basically says, I want to connect every human being on the planet, I think he genuinely said, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, what a wonderful idea. I remember him saying early on that this would be great for world peace because, you know, it would allow people to communicate accurately and honestly. And that, of course, peace would emerge. It just tragically, it seems that has not been the reality. I mean, what's your experience of social media?
Well, exactly, yeah. Something I'm trying to extricate myself from at the moment, because it is, particularly now, I mean, you know, when you scroll through your social media feeds at a time of kind of fevered crisis, as we have at the moment with what's going on in Israel and Gaza, it's just a kind of morass of bad faith arguments and immorality and willful blindness and shouting and anger. And that's just, you know, the opinions, let alone some of the genuinely awful things that have come out of the internet in my adult lifetime. You know, mass shooters, you get radicalized on internet forums, or, you know, genocide gets facilitated by Facebook groups in Myanmar, and anti-Christian persecution in India. And, you know, it's clear that actually a lot of our technology, despite being established with genuinely quite benign intent, has had the effect of kind of maximizing, aggregating human destructiveness and human sinfulness, we would call it, in ways that are that were hard to predict, or at least they thought the programmers would have found it hard to predict.
That's right. And so it's then interesting to see that as technologists and thinkers generally have tried to get their heads around why this is all going on, they've then come up with this concept of what they call the bad actor. In other words, the idea is that most human beings are like us. They're nice, they're liberal, they want nice things to happen, they don't wish harm to anybody. But then there's just a few people, and these are the bad actors, and they're people like, these are willfully damaging people, like cyber criminals, like people deliberately using disinformation and so on. And so provided we can identify bad actors and somehow restrain them, then everything's going to be fine.
And I think that they've stumbled into a kind of moral framework which actually aligns with how the general population, at least in kind of Western secular society, thinks about evil, which is that most human beings are basically good. Sure, we occasionally, you know, tell lies and do wrong things, but we're basically good. But there is a small minority of people who are evil, who are bad, who are irredeemable, and they are the people who, you know, commit murders and are terrorists and, you know, are awful people. And the only really thing to do about those people is to avoid them where you can, and when you find them, to lock them away in prison. And that's the kind of, I think, the kind of moral framework that falls into it. And what is fascinating is how that so often it fails as a kind of explanatory framework for how people act, because we keep stumbling up against the idea that there is a person who has so much evidence in their life of doing good things who then did a really, really terrible thing. And then we struggle because we're like, they don't seem to fit into either of the two categories that we had established for how human beings work.
So one of the fascinating things is that when human beings are meeting face to face, it's clear that there's this kind of constant filtering restraint that goes on. I may think of something, I might feel frustrated by something that the person has said, but our physical presence restrains me from lashing out or from, you know, it's constantly limiting my conversation, and particularly the negative emotions I might express. Whereas once you're in a virtual world, and particularly if it's not real time, I'm responding asynchronously out of real time to a comment that someone else has made. It seems that all those natural restraints are removed, and therefore I'm much more prepared to say really frightful, horrendous, damaging, aggressive things. And this seems to be something about my humanity, but it's quite an unexpected thing, I think, again, from a kind of secular liberal perspective. I mean, why do people say so unpleasant things to each other?
And I think this is the fundamental issue here, is that the kind of slightly naive approach of, you know, there are a few bad actors and everyone else is basically good and does basically good things all the time, just completely fails to grapple with how systemic evil is in our lived experience, and how it's not just the case that bad things in the world come out of a few bad people doing them, but it's that, as you say, when human beings gather together in different ways and different forums, they find themselves almost unconsciously hurting each other and damaging the world around them, even without any genuine malevolent or kind of ill intent. And that is something that I think the secular moral framework really struggles to know how to understand, that kind of the pervasive systemic, you know, way that evil and suffering seems to almost kind of be unavoidable despite a whole bunch of good people trying to do fundamentally good things.
That's right. So then as physicalist secular people try to address this, there are two dominant explanations. Number one, it must be something about our evolution, and it must be something about the fact that we evolved on the African savannah. And people often recreate this wonderful kind of scenario of a small group of hunter-gatherers and where everything is rosy and beautiful. And unfortunately now we evolved with these prehistoric reactions and mindsets, and now we find ourselves in this technological world. And it's the mismatch between our prehistoric brains and our modern tech lifestyles. That's the problem. Or secondly, people say, well, it must be education. It must be the fact that, you know, people start off good and then they get screwed up by their parents and by the whole educational socialization. And if only you could fix the education, then we'll solve the problem.
And so how do we think the Christian perspective on evil, on suffering, is different to the secular worldview we've been unpacking, and how does it offer a better explanatory kind of framework for thinking about evil?
Well, and what's so interesting is that the Christian worldview takes evil very, very seriously. And actually, it goes back even into the pre-Christian Hebraic, the Old Testament world, which for thousands of years before Christ was wrestling with the problem of evil, and the nature of evil, the reality of evil, the consequences of evil. So right back in the very beginning chapters of Genesis, we have this very profound and interesting and countercultural view of evil, which is so much more, I think, subtle and nuanced compared with this quite crude physicalist understanding of where evil comes from.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously people will be very familiar, I'm sure, with the Genesis 3 story, often known as the fall. You know, the serpent comes and whispers things into the ears of Adam and Eve, questioning God's command about not eating from the tree. And the serpent says, you know, if you do eat it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And so Eve takes some and then gives it to Adam. Both of them, their eyes are opened. They realize they're naked. They hide from God. They blame each other or the serpent. And God ultimately curses them and expels them from the garden and places that the angel with the flaming sword to stop them from getting back. You know, what is the view of evil and suffering, do you think, communicated by that complicated and significant story?
I mean, it's a very rich, profound and narrative which, you know, commentators and theologians have wrestled with for centuries, for millennia. But I think there are some fundamental truths here, and it is the idea that evil is already mysteriously, you know, it's already present in the cosmos. So God creates this beautiful world. It's all wonderful. He says it's very good. He's got these wonderful people made in his image. And then there's a voice. There's a voice in the garden. And the origin of that voice is never explained. But there's a voice. And that voice is a personal voice of utter malevolence. It's a voice that is subtle, that is manipulative, but it's a voice that is utterly hostile to everything that God intends. And the very first words are, "Did God really say?" It's questioning, it's challenging, it's asking. And so I think this passage, first of all, just recognizes that evil is far more complex and mysterious than this simplistic view of an evolutionary basis.
But it seems saying that evil is both within and without at the same time. You know, it's that the serpent, separate from Adam and Eve, but yet also possibly created by God, unclear, is the kind of instigator of this destructive choice they make. And yet also it is ultimately Adam and Eve's decision to disobey God and to eat the forbidden fruit that causes all these ripple effects. And so it seems to me, I'm not a theologian, to be saying that the origins of evil both lie without us and within us in some complex mixed up way.
Well, yes, and that in some way the human choice, human desire, human willfulness is part of the mix. And as you say, there is an external evil within a temptation, but there is the human desire, the human fall. And in the language of Genesis, it appears that it's because of this human desire for evil that the entire cosmos is then somehow contaminated. And every aspect of the cosmos is now, although it was created good, it is now in some way contaminated. It is some way affected by evil. And again, this is never fully explained. This is ultimately mysterious. And yet the consequences ripple out from the Garden of Eden throughout the entire cosmos.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this is another clear bit of kind of clear blue water, as it were, between the secular understanding of evil and the Christian one, which is that in a secular world, I think tacitly is this idea that fundamentally only people are bad, whereas actually Christianity teaches that because of the bad choices that human beings have made in choosing to disobey God, that actually, as you say, that ripples out across the entirety of created order. And so now badness, suffering, evil is interwoven with creation itself, and things that were created good now produce bad fruit, and bad things happen that aren't simply the consequence of human decisions, but actually just the world becomes contaminated as well.
Yes, and you know, we have to acknowledge that this is contested ground amongst Christian theologians, and there's a very interesting debate which I'd like to come back to in a future podcast about understanding what is sometimes called natural evil. You know, is it true to say that the natural world is somehow contaminated, or is evil ultimately confined to human beings? So this is contested, but nonetheless, I think the biblical narrative paints a picture of the entire cosmos as broken in some way, as not ultimately reflecting the original creation order. But its brokenness, the creation order is still there. It's not that it's lost completely. It's not disintegrated into chaos. There is still a creation order. There is still a beauty, but it is a broken beauty. It is a flawed masterpiece.
Hmm. And this idea is sometimes being described by theologians as total depravity, which is not that everything that we do and everything is depraved, but that the corruption of sin has not left anything unscathed. And that all of our thought processes and our actions and our words and the world around us is all marred and affected and corrupted in small and bigger ways by sin, that nothing has been left untouched. And that's very, I think that's probably controversial or even offensive to kind of secular people.
Absolutely. I think it's at this point that most secular philosophers and actually... many other people will just throw up their hands in horror and say that at that point, you've lost me. This is simply unacceptable. I cannot accept this understanding of evil. I retain the view that we are fundamentally good. Yeah, we have our little problems. But this idea that that everything I do is contaminated by evil, that evil contaminates every aspect of the creation, I just can't go there. This is unacceptable. This is offensive. And I will reject Christianity as a result.
And why? What is driving that? Do you think that's because people fundamentally don't like the idea that they are, you know, broken like a stick of Brighton rock? You snap them in half and a stripe of suffering, of evil, of brokenness runs all the way through the middle of them. They just find that personally upsetting. That doesn't cohere with the idea of themselves they have.
Well, I suppose one of the great fears is if I really believed that, then the only possible route is despair. If that is really the case, that all humanity is curdled by some terrible flaw, then there is no hope. There is no, I mean, you. The only possible route is of utter despair, cynicism, and I don't want to live like that. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to go there. It's just too horrible to look into that abyss. And therefore, I will tell myself it can't be right. It can't be true. I'm fundamentally a good person. You're fundamentally a good person. Human beings are fundamentally good, and we can make a better world.
Hmm. And this, I think, comes down to the fact that all sin is ultimately kind of self-deceptive. You know, Satan is the father of lies, and And you see that there in Genesis 3. You know, it wasn't that he egged on Adam and Eve and said, go on, why didn't you just indulge the evil part of yourself, the disobedient part of yourself, the wicked part of yourself? No, he flattered them with lies and said, actually, he indulged their desire to deceive themselves and say, actually, by doing something they knew was wrong, that God had told them not to do, they were actually doing a good thing. And I think that's fundamentally true of all of us, that we all really fundamentally believe that we're doing good stuff and we're making good choices. And few of us, I think, really are willing to kind of pierce that bubble of self-deception and see ourselves as we really are.
Yes. And it is, I mean, it's a hard saying, isn't it? And you could see this in Jesus's ministry as well, in the Gospels, that as long as he was saying nice things about God and so on as a father, and I've come to bring, you know, peace and so on, that was fine. But when he talked about the reality of evil and people reacted against that, this was a hard saying. So I think we have to acknowledge that this is one of those crux points where, as Christianity, as a way of understanding the world, really it engages in a difficult way with reality. And yet, I think that intuitively, many people, as they listen to the news, they watch on their screens, they see their social media feeds, actually this resonates, doesn't it? This takes evil seriously.
Mm. Another lens of looking at this is sometimes through the doctrine that's sometimes called original sin, you know, which is the idea that Christianity teaches that, you know, human beings aren't born perfect and innocent and then at some point kind of acquire their brokenness, but actually that brokenness is baked in from the start. And again, this is hugely offensive. I think often, you know, a lot of moderns would say this is some of the most pernicious teaching of Christianity, that, you know, even these beautiful little babies are marred by sinfulness. And yet at the same time, as every parent can testify, you know, we see in our children from as soon as they can walk and think and talk that they do decide and act and do things that are destructive to themselves and to others, that hurt themselves and hurt others, and that don't really seem to make any sense. They keep choosing bad things. And so we kind of intuitively know it, and yet we also react and reject and say, no, I can't deal with that as an idea.
That's right. And I mean, every parent discovers this, doesn't they? That this wonderful little bundle that is so innocent and so precious and so wonderful, and then somewhere this little spirit inside starts to want to assert itself and to fight back and to say no, and I don't want, and it's not fair, and I'm not going to do that. And so again, you say, well, is this an evolutionary phenomenon? Is this bad upbringing, or is there something deeper? And again, I'm just reminded of what Jesus said, you know, to the Pharisees, who spent their whole time worrying about external purity. And he says, what corrupts a person is not what they comes into them, it's what comes out of their heart. He said, out of the human heart comes all kinds of evil. And that's what you see in a young child. That's what you see on social media.
And that's why the heart of the gospel is that the problem lies with the human heart, not with the world around us. The problem to the brokenness and the suffering of the world around us lies inside us, and therefore the only solution is a heart transplant, a spiritual heart transplant, which is what Jesus offers us, you know, when we're born again. And I guess that leads us to this idea that actually the fall and the Christian conception of sin, suffering and evil is actually quite a unique contribution, a unique idea, a narrative that we can offer a wider world grappling, confused and scrambling about trying to find a way to explain the brokenness it sees around it.
Yes, and a very interesting voice in this is John Gray, who is a secular philosopher based in London, who is not at all a believer in God, or a Christian believer, and he attacks the idea of Christianity, the whole structure of Christianity. But he's very interesting because he says modern liberal humanism is basically a Christian heresy. It's taken the idea that human beings are special and are wonderful, but has just removed all the metaphysical underpinnings. And interestingly, Gray goes on to say, and for this reason, liberal humanism is much more dangerous than Christianity. He says Christianity is dangerous enough as an idea, but at least Christianity balances the idea of the specialness of humanity with the recognition of evil. He says the problem with liberal humanism is that it just takes the specialness of humanity, but it has no understanding. It has no concept of the fall. And he says that makes liberal humanism much more dangerous because of its lack of reality.
Hmm. And I think we can see that, as we were discussing earlier on, with kind of, you know, the monuments to liberal, secular, naturalist humanism that we've built in the 21st century, our internet culture, our societies, they are completely kind of struggling to deal with the reality of evil as this kind of emergent property that seeps out of everything we touch, despite our best intentions. And that actually we do need and you can see that even in the small area of, like, you know, content moderation on social media platforms, all the way up to much bigger problems, that everyone is almost looking for a different way, a better way of explaining evil and managing evil and restraining evil. But fundamentally there needs to be a intellectual, a philosophical, a theological reframing of the problem before you can then get to the right policy prescription at the end.
Yeah, so the fascinating idea is that what technology does, particularly this new information technology, social media, ChatGPT, all these things, they basically amplify what is going on in our human hearts and minds. When we're as untechnologically enhanced human beings, a lot of this is just hidden inside us, inside our minds, and it's limited to our finite embodiment. But this technology is a massive amplifier of what is hidden, of what is going on inside us. And as it amplifies this in extraordinary ways, often what we see is not a very pretty sight. Yes, there are lots of very positive things. I mean, again, one doesn't want to fall into this completely negative perspective. Of course, you know, it amplifies good things. It amplifies science. It amplifies, you know, funny cat videos. It amplifies, you name it, you know, lots of very positive things. But it also amplifies, to many people's surprise, the level of hatred, of the vicious thoughts and destructive thoughts that are inside ordinary human beings' hearts.
And I guess the Christian response is to be unsurprised by that, because the Christian story says, well, if you just simply put rocket fuel underneath the unchanged human nature, you're going to get fireworks, but in both bad and good ones. If you massively amplify and, you know, take away some of the physical limits and the finitude that was baked into us as human beings, yeah, you're going to get some fantastic stuff, but yes, you're going to get some lots of awful stuff. And that's why I guess the Christian answer is that human beings do best, we flourish when we are restrained to an extent, when we live within the guardrails set by our God, our creator, who understands better than us our propensities and our capacities for evil. And I guess a great way of explaining that idea would be the story in Genesis, shortly after Genesis 3, of the Tower of Babel.
So the Tower of Babel, again, you know, actually, I haven't thought about this before, but you could say this is an example of the amplification of how technology amplifies human evil. So you've got in the narrative, you've got individual human evil. You've got Cain, who murders his own brother, you know, at an individual level. But in Genesis chapter 11, you get the story of the Tower of Babel, which is the sort of when human beings come together and they say, let us make a tower. And it's a kind of, it's clearly a sort of parody of what God himself, the triune God, said when he said, let us make human beings in our image. But now human beings are saying, we've got the technology and we are going to make a tower and we're going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to disobey the God who told us to spread out across the earth. Instead, we're going to come down, we're going to build a city, and we're going to make a name to ourselves. And now God says, now they're of one language and of one purpose, and there is nothing that they wish to do will be impossible for them. There is no limit to what they can achieve. And then God, in the story, steps in and confuses the languages. So again, the Tower of Babel, I think, has a kind of new resonance in this current age, because it's something about collective human power that has unexpected consequences.
Hmm. And there's a kind of riposte to the hyper-liberal libertarian spirit that says, you know, human beings should accept no limitations and no one can constrain me. And actually the Christian message is, actually, we do best, we thrive when we do live within the good restraints and the good limits set by God. And you see that in Genesis 3, when God expels Adam and Eve from the garden, he then bars their entry with the angel with the flaming sword. Not just because, you know, he's a spoil sport, but because God knew that actually, if these now broken and sinful human beings were to regain entry back into the perfect garden and start eating from the fruit of the other tree, you know, the consequences would be catastrophic. And so it's out of God's love as our Father that he sets these rules and guardrails. And the kind of the story of scripture, and I think to this day, is of humans bucking against the rules and the good limits set by God. But actually a faithfully Christian response is that actually an untrammeled society which doesn't constrain humans is only going to tend towards more evil and more suffering. So we do need some kind of constraint, as long as they're the right kind of godly constraints.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, you know, within this story of the garden, you know, that the imagery is of a garden which is just resplendent with fruit, with every possible kind of fruit. And God says, you can eat of any single tree. It's all for you. If you want mangoes, you want mangoes. You want passion fruit, you want apples. You know, it's all, you know, it's all up for you. You choose. I'm not going to tell you what to eat. You know, enjoy it all. But there's just one tree that you shouldn't eat from. And of course, the human beings go for that one tree. But the tree that was also standing there, as you say, is the tree of life. And within this imagery of the garden, it seems that if you eat the tree of life, you live forever. And in order to prevent the fallen human beings, they could have chosen, it seems, to have eaten from that tree to begin with. It was open to them. But instead, they chose to eat from the one tree that they were not allowed to. Now God says, I will prevent you from eating the tree of life and living forever. And I think within that imagery, that means that to live forever in a fallen state is not a blessing, it's a curse. And it's out of grace and goodness that God prevents human beings from living forever. And to be honest, we see that, that death is a way, the fact that all human beings die is a way of limiting their evil.
Yeah.
I mean, as we look across the world and we see some terrible human dictators, we see human beings who are doing such evil, like Putin, or like other dictators in elsewhere across the world. The one thing you know is that Putin's evil is going to come to an end, because, thank God, and I say that, you know, it's a strange thing to say, isn't it? But I say it with almost painfully. Thank God, Putin is going to die. And when he dies, his evil is going to come to an end. And that's why death is actually a severe mercy. In Christian thinking, it's not just it's a limitation of evil.
And it underlines this kind of paradoxical approach that, you know, I know you've written about lots as from kind of the medical side, which is that we intuitively feel that death is an enemy and an intruder in this world, and we grieve it, stealing people away from us. And as a doctor, you fight against it with all your might. And yet at the same time, it's not solely an evil, and it's not, and that, yes, the God's intention was for us to live forever, but we're not inherently eternal in the way that he is. You know, the reason Adam and Eve would have lived forever in the garden is because they were eating of the tree, i.e. the metaphor there is that they are being sustained by God's eternalness. And it is when, but that is not inherent to human beings, that actually we are still created, and it's only in communion with God, when we are living right with him in his presence, that we do live forever.
That's right. So, I mean, just to sort of bring this into land, I think what we tried to just scrape the surface of, really, of a very rich and profound understanding of evil in the scriptures. There's much more we could say about, the way that the problem of innocent suffering is grappled with in the book of Job, the laments, the whole concept of lament, and so on. So but I think what I'm trying to illustrate is how rich and nuanced the Christian understanding of evil is compared to this very simplistic and naive understanding, I think, that you often find amongst scientists and technologists. And I personally think this is something that we as Christians have to offer to this current debate going on in the tech world. I think that Christians have a unique contribution to make in this debate about AI safety, about social media, about the appropriate use of technology. Of course, everybody in a democratic society has a voice. Everybody has a contribution to make. But I do think the Christian voice and our understanding of evil is one of the things that we can contribute to this debate.
Yeah, I mean, one way I've often heard it expressed is that Christianity is both simultaneously more pessimistic and more optimistic about human nature and evil than our wider society is. You know, we're more pessimistic in that we don't believe evil is simply confined to a small handful of bad actors. We believe it's kind of written into all of our DNA, as it were, spiritually speaking. But we're also optimistic. We don't just believe that, you know, people are bad and need to be restrained, but Christianity also says the end of the story is that people will be redeemed. You know, like we talked about, that God's desire, yearning, is to take out our hearts of stone and replace them with hearts of flesh, to write the law onto our hearts so that, you know, in his perfect new creation, we won't need to be constrained like we were in Babel, with confusion about different languages, or, you know, with a complex system of checks and balances in modern political constitutions, because we will be redeemed and perfected, and God will replace our brokenness with an unmarred humanity. So we're both optimistic about the future and yet very realistic about the present.
That's right. And so there's a fundamental paradox here. The Christian understanding of reality and the Christian understanding of humanity is fundamentally paradox. It's interesting. It was Pascal, the brilliant scientist, mathematician, but also a Christian believer, who was really the first to express this very, very clearly. He said that the way that we engage, the way that we can help people to see the reality of Christianity is by actually focusing on the paradoxes. It's the paradoxes that have the power. And I see what he means. You know, I've often found that myself, that there's sometimes a temptation when one is talking about Christian faith to try and make it just seem very reasonable, very ordinary, very, very basic, very commonsensical. And I think that's a mistake, because when we make Christianity commonsensical, we cut the nerve of its power. The whole point is it isn't commonsensical. It isn't simple. It isn't reasonable. It's profoundly paradoxical. And the power of the faith is in the paradox. And Pascal expressed it beautifully when he said that human beings are the glory and the shame of the universe. you know, they're not just ordinary. They are something incredibly wonderful and something incredibly broken and shameful. And it's in that very paradox that you see the power of this Christian perspective.
Absolutely. Well, that seems like a convenient place to draw to a close. Thank you for listening. I hope you found that an interesting kind of whistle-stop tour. Obviously, we've only really scratched the surface of the richness of Christian thinking around the fall and suffering and evil. Do go on, read more, research more. It's really important, good stuff. But I hope that kind of helps lay a bit more of the framework. We'll finish off our series some point later this year, or maybe early in the new year, looking at redemption, the next kind of phases of redemption, and then finally new creation, recreation later on. But there's lots more writing around, particularly around Christianity, on Dad's website. Lots of sermons he's done over the years are uploaded there. So do go to johnwyatt.com. And as always, we're really interested in your questions, in your thoughts, your feedback, your disagreements. Please do get in touch with us. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we will speak to you next week with another episode. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.